Do you, Chris, take this woman to be your lawfully wedded wife? Do you promise to barrage her with obscure facts concerning comics, movies, TV shows, and toys?
I do.
And Cindy, do you take this man-child to be your lawfully wedded husband? Do you promise to humor him by engaging him in his obsessive ramblings, for better or worse, in pre-crisis or in post?
Sure, why not?
Then by the power invested in me by the High Father of the Fourth World, I now pronounce you Supermates. You may podcast with the bride.
Hello and welcome to episode 19 of Supermates, the Husband and Wife Geekcast. I'm Chris.
I'm Cindy.
And before we jump into our Star Trek discussion, which if you, you know, checked your iTunes or checked our websites, you know what we're going to talk about. I thought we'd talk about another iconic 60s TV series briefly. This week, a few days ago as we record this, the long-awaited, much-anticipated release of the 1960s Batman TV series came out finally. And I was happy to find it on my doorstep the day it came out.
Mm-hmm.
I've been tearing through that, watched all the special features, which are really great, and I was so glad that they actually did do a good number of special features, little mini documentaries and things like that, because TV shows and movies have really gotten skimpy with special features.
Oh, yeah.
Compared to what they were even a few years ago. I mean, the days of a really good, you know, DVD, Blu-ray set having a lot of special features are kind of gone, unfortunately. But this set has been chock full of good stuff. I've watched a few episodes here and there, and man, they did a great job cleaning this show up. I've never seen it look this good. Batman's blues are actually blue. They're not purple. Just the color, the sound, everything is just fantastic. I mean, we'll probably talk about it again down the line later. Just real briefly, it is great. I have heard some people have had some problems with the menus on the discs. I haven't run into anything yet, but I've, you know, bounced around. There's a ton of discs in there. I don't even know how many there are. So far, I haven't seen anything. But I will say this. Actually, on our next episode, if everything goes right, our special guest will actually be somebody who can be seen in the credits on this set.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, okay, who is it? Is it? Did they get Adam West? Yeah, right.
Nah, not so much. However, we have spoken with Adam West at conventions, and the man, I'm sorry, he still has a voice like butter.
Like butter, yeah. I think we've discussed his voice like butter before.
Possibly. I can't help it, you know. 80 years old. I don't know. I could still talk to him.
Yeah. Adam West actually, you know, in the special features, he still looks incredibly good for an 86-year-old. And one thing, my buddy Tom, who's one of the guys that posts on the Mingo Museum a lot, he pointed out that you really kind of get more of a picture of the real Adam West on some of these features. Mm-hmm. You know, he is really good at always playing up the public facade of Adam West, still almost in character as Batman in many ways,
right.
Or at least Bruce Wayne. There's one documentary on there called Hanging with Batman, which is really a stupid title for a really good mini documentary on Adam West. You really kind of get to see more of the real Adam West, and it covers the lean years. Of course, it covers his early years and pre-Batman work, and then, of course, the meteoric rise of Batman. But it also doesn't sugarcoat the very lean years where he, you know, basically would show up in a Batman costume anywhere to just get a, you know, make a living. You know, it's a very fair look at the whole thing, and you really kind of get more of an idea of probably what the real Adam West is like than anything I've ever seen before, and I can't say that's my observation. That's my buddy Tom's, but he's right. But stay tuned at the end of this episode, and we'll tell you who's gonna be the guest. But it's obviously not one of the actors involved with the show, which unfortunately there's not many left. But it is somebody who did contribute to the special features. So we'll discuss that later on. So why don't we talk about some Star Trek?
Yes.
Okay. Well,
you waxed poetic for a while.
Hey, it's only about 4.5 minutes. So about a month or so ago, we went to the comic shop we have started frequenting in Lexington, Kentucky, called Heroes Realm, which is a really cool comic shop. We just happened to go in there. We go up there about every 2 months or something.
And yeah, about every 6-7 weeks.
Pick up the books in my pull file, which aren't many. Batman 66, which we will eventually review on this show, at least some of the books, is one of them I get. But there are a few books I've been eyeballing, and I'm like, oh, maybe I ought to pick those up. And you know, but I had no problem picking up stuff that day. Everything in the store, every comic in the store, on the shelf and in the back issue bins, was $1.
$1?
$1.
Even my tightwad butt didn't mind picking up.
Yeah, it was $1, and I'm like, holy cow. And so, of course, I picked up a lot of cool, you know, old back issues. I got quite a few issues from the Mike Zeck, DeMatteis Captain America run, which I read as it came out, but I didn't get all the issues thanks to the spotty newsstand distribution. So I picked up quite a few of those I was missing. Picked up a few All-Star Squadrons and some other cool books. The kids all got comics, plenty of comics to read. And there were two books in particular there on the shelf that I have been eyeballing for quite some time. And these are the Star Trek New Visions books by John Byrne. Now, in case you don't know what these are, they are the photo novel books that John Byrne has been doing. They are, some people would call them fumetti, which is the Italian term. But they take photographs and make comics out of them. These aren't simple adaptations of the actual episodes of Star Trek. He's making brand new stories using imagery from the series. But I have been very interested in these, but the $7.99 price tag on them.
Right. I mean, you've picked them up several times, and then you'd be like, oh, well, it's $8.
Yeah, and I thought, well, maybe if there's a trade paperback, I'll pick that up. But for $1 a piece, and I went and asked the owner, and I'm like, are these $1 too? And he's like, yep. I said, man, I don't even know if I feel right about buying them for $1. And he's like, well, if you have a problem with it. And I'm like, no, I'll take them. So I picked there were about four that were released at this point, but they only had two on the shelf. The very first one they did, which is the annual, which is called Strange New Worlds. It was the Star Trek annual from last year, and then the actual New Vision series started after this, and number one was missing, but I did get issue number two, and so that's what we're going to talk about today. I picked these up, you know, and slightly one reason I was a little trepidatious about this was I'm a huge Star Trek fan of classic Trek, and I have quite a few Star Trek comics, but in general, comic adaptations of TV shows or movies, I've never really felt like anyone just jumped out at me and said, this is it. You know, this they really captured the feel,
tone.
If the artwork, if they capture the actor's likenesses, oftentimes it's very stiff. You know, if it's either they don't look like the actors, or if they do look like the actors, there's so much photo reference going on, it's stiff.
Mm.
A lot of times the very pacing of the stories do not feel like the show or the movie they're emulating. The voices of the characters sound wrong. I just don't feel like there's been a lot of comics that I've read
that have been successful.
Right. Now, not to get back on Batman 66, but quite a few of those issues feel really good to me about that. But in general, with Star Trek, the DC run in the 80s was fairly close, but it was kind of an odd time because it was coming out as the movies were coming out, so it kept getting tripped up in the continuity as continuity evolved in the movies. You know, you were in an odd space, and the stories that they set back in the past during the TV show era usually played better to me. But they still, and I mean, they had some good writers working on that, some good artists, but, you know, it still wasn't quite exactly what I would hope to get out of an adaptation. Obviously, with John Byrne's take, you had a lot of potential because he's using the actual photographs of the actors.
Right.
And we all know, you know, John Byrne. I'm not going to go into the history of John Byrne. Obviously, John Byrne is one of the superstar talents of comics. You know, he made his name pretty much on the X-Men during the early days of the all-new X-Men. You know, he went to Fantastic Four and basically gave that book a shot in the arm and brought it back to its glory days of Lee and Kirby. and that's the first book he was really a writer on. And then DC came calling to him and said, hey, you want to revamp Superman? You know, so,
right.
So I mean, you know, John Byrne's one of the superstar talents of the of comic history. And, you know, he has, for various reasons, not done a lot of work for Marvel and DC in the last decade or so. So part of the reason, because, you know, he's sometimes a fairly controversial figure with his opinions, but he has always been a fan of Star Trek. And he has done other work for IDW, who is the publisher of these comics, which I have yet to bring up, which is bad. But IDW has been publishing Star Trek comics for several years, and Byrne has done some work for them. You know, picking up the first issue, there's actually a little feature in that where Byrne talks about why he's doing this, and we'll get to that as we get into the comic itself. But the first thing you really need to know about the first book is, which is called Strange New Worlds, and as I said, it was IDW Star Trek Annual for last year, for 2013, is that it is a sequel to the episode where No Man Has Gone Before, which every good Trek fan knows is the second pilot of Star Trek, the first to feature Captain Kirk. We all know that The Cage was the first pilot with Jeffrey Hunter as Captain Pike, and NBC felt it was too cerebral, but we liked the basic idea of it. Go make another one, make it more action-packed.
Cowboy it up.
Cowboy it up. So they couldn't get or didn't want Hunter because apparently his wife was a pain in the neck. And so they got Shatner and you know, chose to name him Kirk instead of keeping him as Pike. The only actor they kept on was Leonard Nimoy. And there you go. The rest is history.
Well,
so,
Majel Barrett made the move from number one to Nurse Jackie.
Yeah, eventually, but she's not in where No Man Has Gone Before.
But if you're talking about who made the series jump, she made the series
jump. Well,
it
didn't hurt that she was, you know.
I know, but...
friends with the creator.
But
producer.
You can't say only Leonard Nimoy with
Well,
Majel Barrett,
he was the only one that was kept in the cast, because she was not kept in the cast of this. Eventually, she was in the cast of...
You didn't say the episode. This is the series.
All right. Whatever.
Concede. Love you.
No. You're wrong.
Captain's log. Stardate 1312.4. The next mission of the Enterprise takes us into an unknown force field which affects the destiny of my closest friend.
I understand you least of all. Gary told me that you've been friends since he joined the service, that you asked for him aboard your first command.
It is my duty, whether pleasant or unpleasant, to listen to the reports, observations, even speculations on any subject that might affect the safety of this vessel.
It's like a man who has been blind all of his life, suddenly being given sight. Sometimes I feel there's nothing I couldn't do in time. Some people think that makes me a monster, don't they, Jip?
What would you do in my place?
Kill me.
In case you have forgotten, we're going to, I think it's necessary that we read a brief synopsis of Where No Man Has Gone Before. And it's from Phil Ferran's The Nitpicker's Guide for Classic Trekkers. I picked this one because it's a lot shorter than the one in the Star Trek Companion.
Your synopsis.
I didn't synopsize this. That's why I'm just going to read it.
Oh, for cripes. Okay, hit it.
Approaching the edge of the galaxy, the crew of the Enterprise encounters the ship recorder of the USS Valiant. According to the 200-year-old record, the Valiant encountered an energy barrier at the edge of the galaxy. Six crewmen died. A seventh finally recovered. Then the crew became very interested in ESP. Although uncertain, Spock thinks the last item on the tape is the captain ordering the ship's destruction. Kirk decides to press on with the mission and continues to the edge of the galaxy. Soon the Enterprise hits the energy barrier as well. Control panels short circuit, the ship tosses about, and two officers collapse on the bridge before Kirk retreats. The two officers, Lieutenant Commander Gary Mitchell and Dr. Elizabeth Daner, seem to recover quickly. Mitchell soon develops new abilities, among them the ability to read minds and move objects by thought command alone. When Kirk tries to strand him at the lithium cracking station on Delta Vega, Mitchell escapes with Daner. She has begun to develop supernatural abilities as well. Desperate to stop Mitchell, Kurt grabs a phaser rifle and pursues them. He manages to convince Daner of the dangers of ultimate power. Aided by the sacrifice of her own life, Kurt kills Mitchell before the newly formed God can destroy them all. Which is actually a fairly good synopsis. He leaves out the fact that at the end, Kirk decides to list both of them as dying in the line of duty, right, rather than to go into detail, which is important for the comic we're about to cover.
Gary Mitchell was his oldest friend from Academy days.
Right. You know, I just haven't rewatched this episode just recently for this show. You know, I know this is the pilot. You know, the characters aren't going to be as fleshed out. They're not going to be exactly the same as we would come to know them. But the whole Enterprise crew really seems rather quick to either want to destroy or abandon Mitchell. So Spock immediately wants to kill him. I mean, he's like, kill him, Captain. You know, it's just, I mean, just right off the bat. You know, this is not the Spock who would mind meld with the Horda later.
Right.
You know, when it's killing all these guys in this, you know, mining colony.
Well, you have to think, that's the whole point of Star Trek, is that you go and explore. You go and try to understand the universe around you. You don't destroy it on contact just because you don't get it.
You don't
first.
Understand it, right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, Kirk even gives in rather quickly, which is, you know, like you said, they're his oldest friend. Really, at that point, when they decide to abandon him on Delta Vega, all he's really done is made a few rather cryptic, I'm superior type comments and messed around a little bit with the ship's controls. He hasn't tried to kill anybody or anything. It's only when, you know, they say they're going to do this to him that he starts zapping people. You know, in contrast, it just so happened I watched that one and I decided to watch Charlie X, which is a first season episode, because I hadn't seen it in a long time. You know, Charlie X also features a character who has very extraordinary, unexplainable, godlike powers.
Right, right.
And
he's a kid.
He's a kid, you know, and...
Well, teenager, but
teenager,
still.
Teenager, yeah. They're a lot more understanding of him. They don't know this kid. I know he's a kid, but they're maybe a little bit too understanding because he actually makes a crew member disappear, and as far as they know, the guy's dead. And this is after he made all these other little unexplainable things that they should have really been questioning him about. They just kind of shrug their shoulders and go on. Well, then he makes a crew member disappear right in front of Kirk because he was laughing at him. And, you know, they assume the guy's dead. He takes over the entire ship, which is what they fear what Mitchell was going to do, and they waffle on how to handle it. I mean, they don't even really mention killing him or deserting him. It never comes up.
Right.
It's funny how quickly the series started to take shape and the way the characters would react. I would actually say that they're a little... there's a happy medium somewhere, and somewhere in there lies the version of the characters we really think of, you know. But anyway, so, you know, when I picked this comic up, I knew that this was a sequel to...
No Man Has Gone Before,
Star Trek Annual from December 2013, because the cover depicts the glowing, ethereal face of Gary Mitchell. It's got photos of Kirk, Spock, and McCoy on a very 60s-looking geometric color shapes. They got it looks like something from the 60s. The Enterprise and a Klingon battlecruiser also appear. One thing that does stand out to me on this cover is Shatner looks like he has on way too much eyeshadow. I mean, it's just, you know, I mean, it's just the makeup of the time, but it's like really, like, it's like, it probably comes from one of the earlier episodes where they tended to really did, like, have really thick makeup on all the men, it seemed like. Maybe the guys got happy, you know, doing Spock, they just went crazy with everybody else. There's a humorous opening page titled Pieces of the Action, which, of course, is a play on the classic Star Trek episode, Piece of the Action, where John Byrne places a 1968 photo of his face on the bodies of various Star Trek actors. And he, you know, he vaguely explains his process of doing this photo comic and how the whole idea came to him. And he had actually contemplated doing a lost episode using editing together video elements and audio to create a lost episode. But then it came to him that, hey, it'd be easier to do in a comic. So there you go.
Strange New Worlds Photo Montage and Story by John Byrne, based on characters created by Samuel Peeples. Star Trek, of course, created by Gene Roddenberry. The Enterprise picks up a strange signal that seems to emanate from everywhere. Spock eventually traces the signal to planet Delta Vega near the Galactic Rim. For the older veterans of the Enterprise, the very name of this planet causes them pause. Despite this and his own personal misgivings, Captain Kirk orders the ship to Delta Vega. Arriving at the planet, Kirk beams to the surface with Spock and Dr. McCoy. The captain sends his two friends to check the dilithium cracking station while he heads towards the graves of Gary Mitchell and Elizabeth Danner. McCoy relates that he knows the real story behind the encounter at Delta Vega thanks to the personal log of former ship's surgeon Mark Piper, and despite the official story, Kirk reported to the contrary. Picking up more focused energy readings, Spock suggests they beam back aboard the ship and use the scanners there. Kirk refuses to leave and orders Spock and McCoy to return to the ship to begin their scanning. The two materialize in the transporter room as usual, but then disappear in a white light. As the remaining Enterprise crew tries to decipher what is going on, the ship is pulled into a strange white energy field. On the planet's surface, Kirk finds a great forest of vegetation on the otherwise barren planet. The graves of Mitchell and Danner are undisturbed, and he wonders if his instincts were wrong about Mitchell being behind all this. However, the voice of Gary Mitchell tells him he is not wrong, and soon the captain finds himself aboard the Enterprise of 4 years ago. He is being forced to relive an encounter with the Klingons, an encounter that left the ship heavily damaged, and Gary Mitchell near death. Kirk acts out the scenario just as before, saving Mitchell from falling through the debris of the damaged ship into the void of space. His part played, Kirk is transported again to Delta Vega. There, the face of Gary Mitchell appears to him, and he asks why he once risked his life for him, only to kill him later. As his crew struggles to find a way out of their energy trap, Kirk reappears on the bridge. Kirk theorizes Mitchell is creating scenarios from his jumbled memories and is unable to create a complete scenario for the Enterprise since he doesn't know the current crew. Reversing their previous course, they break free and Kirk beams back down to the surface. Meanwhile, Spock and McCoy are drawn into their own replay of history, with McCoy playing Mark Piper. They reenact the Enterprise's encounter with the rat creatures of Demoris, where Gary Mitchell took a poison dart for Kirk. They return to the present, and Spock is able to telepathically connect with Mitchell. The energy mass that was Mitchell takes on the image of his former self as Kirk arrives on the scene. He offers to help his old friend and show him what they did to him was out of necessity. Having evolved so far past his former humanity, Mitchell finds it difficult to read human minds, so Spock offers to help via his mind meld. He connects the minds of Mitchell and Kirk, but the captain is dismayed to find his old friend replaying their final battle. Mitchell relates how the destruction of his body released his spirit, and he connected to Delta Vega, becoming the planet. He called out to the Enterprise to enact his revenge, but Kirk believes he is beyond that, or he would have already destroyed him. Eventually, the captain convinces him that his thirst for vengeance is only the result of him trying to hang on to the last shreds of his humanity. Taking his old friend's advice, Gary Mitchell lets go and joins with the waiting universe. Sometime later, back aboard the Enterprise, Captain Kirk contacts Starfleet and finally comes clean on the fate of Gary Mitchell and Elizabeth Danner. The Commodore in command, the former first officer of the Enterprise under Captain Christopher Pike, is not unsympathetic to Kirk's actions. As the crew resume their usual duties and lives, Dr. McCoy has only one question. Why wasn't the mentally powered Spock affected by his trip through the galactic barrier? Spock responds, "I wonder, Doctor, why you assume I wasn't."
That's a heck of a stinger at the end. You know, right off the bat, this feels like real Star Trek. I mean, the dialogue, the pacing, you can just imagine where the music cues come in and, like, you know, the commercial breaks and the stingers, you know. I mean, if you know Star Trek, you know all the musical library and everything, and you can just hear it in your head. Well, I mean, what did you think? Did you feel like it?
Yeah, I liked this one. And I'll be honest, and we'll talk about this later, but of the two stories, this one is stronger, I think.
Mm. See, I don't know. I kind of disagree on which one I think's stronger, but we'll talk about it. Mm. But, you know, fans have always kind of wondered, you know, is Gary Mitchell ever going to come back? I mean...
Well, the fact that he was, you know, he's a godlike being and he just got killed by a slab of rock.
Right, right.
You know, it seemed too easy.
Right, right. I mean, you could say that he was weakened enough from Daynor's attack and everything, but... Yeah, that's one part of it, definitely. And I mean, you know, it makes you wonder, it would have been maybe kind of neat if Star Trek V would have had a lot more weight. I mean, they even went through the galactic barrier if God that they encountered was Gary Mitchell. That would have been cool. Yeah, that would have been cool. And I don't know if Gary Lockwood might have still been alive at that point, too. I'm not sure.
What does God need with a starship?
That's right. I need my pain. I want my pain. Bang! Anyway, I like Star Trek V. I don't care. I know it's not the best, but the campfire scenes and some of it.
There's some good character bits
in that movie. Yeah, you know, old Uhura doing the fan dance. You know, I mean, not she's a very attractive lady for her age, but at some point you should, you know, not be doing that. So yeah, that was kind of unfortunate.
Aww. What am I going to do in 30 years?
Well, don't be fan dancing in front of a bunch of weird alien terrorists or whatever, you know? Another thing, you know, I think there was when Benedict Cumberbatch was cast in Into Darkness, nobody knew exactly who he was.
Right.
And he had this name that they gave him that everybody's, oh, that's bogus. And there was like two theories I heard. One, he was Khan, which, spoiler warning, he's Khan. And two, he's Gary Mitchell. So I think a lot of people probably would have been happier if he'd been Gary Mitchell instead of Khan, because it's more sacred ground.
Right.
But anyway, right off the bat, Byrne really nails the voices of the characters. I mean, you can just hear Shatner. And of course, you're looking at Shatner as you read this. So that I think that helps. But there's very few points in these where, and I'll mention those when they do come up, but there's only a couple little points where it pops out at you like, that actor as that character wouldn't say that back in 1967, '68, '69.
Right.
You know, there's only a few times like that. He particularly nails Shatner, Nimoy, and Kelly, but of course those guys are the main characters. So
right.
And they got a lot more dialogue. It's easier to capture the way they talk. Of course, now I'm a graphic designer by trade. That's my day job. I use Photoshop every day. And that's another aspect of this that's fascinating to me because I can say, okay, what did he do here? You know, he probably used a rubber stamp tool to get rid of the characters over like a character that would have been in this background. And as a Star Trek fan, I'm not quite at the level where I could pick out every single, okay, he pulled this image from here and he pulled Kirk from this episode and Spock from this episode. And this is this background from here. And I'm not quite there, but it was interesting to see, you know, just kind of stop and think, well, how did he put this together? Now, he did, I would say in this one, because it is a sequel, it was a little bit easier to do than, like, the next one we'll talk about, which is an all-original story, because he basically could use images from, for the most part, I'm not saying any of this was easy, but he could use images from Where No Man Has Gone Before, and of course he could use the Enterprise images from any number of episodes.
Right.
And the number of, you know, the configuration of characters there's going to be plenty of opportunity to pull them from that. The flashback to Where No Man Has Gone Before, Bones relates that he knows what really happened, and Spock says, well, why don't you tell me what you know, basically.
Right.
And you go through a flashback to Where No Man Has Gone Before. Now, you know, obviously that was just simple screen grabbing for the most part. But still very well done. Byrne has said there's another, and we'll get to that, there's another special feature in the back of the book where Byrne goes into more detail on how he did all this. He says he stuck to images from the first two seasons as much as possible because the characters' hairstyles and body shapes changed quite a bit in the third and final season, and he couldn't fit them in as well.
Right.
And they even bring up the fact that, you know, if you really pay attention to Star Trek, then, you know Shatner, he gets beefier, you know, here and there, you know, at different points in the season. It's usually when the season starts out, he's been working out, he's pretty slim, and then he never gets fat, but he gets beefy, you know, beefier. Right. And by the third season, definitely his hair's getting longer. It's slightly getting curlier. Scotty goes to like two different, he gets the slick back haircut and then the Clooney Caesar cut, you know. And so, I mean, you know, that would, and in fact, that there's one image of Scotty, I think it's in this issue, where it looks a little bit like, I think he's from behind. And to me, it looks like Scotty from season three, where he's got that kind of Caesar cut where his salt and pepper hair is starting to come through. He doesn't have the greasy black hair as much, but he tried to stick to season one and two for the most part, because there's a lot more consistency there. There was one.
You showed this to me.
Noticeable goof on page 15. The pages aren't numbered, but I think it's page 15. We see Kirk on a desert background, and off to his left we see a bare lower leg, like the calf muscle, and right under the knee of somebody's leg. It seems like, you know, Byrne didn't quite rubber stamp out an actor from this scene. I don't know what that could have been from. Maybe it was like from the Savage Curtain or something. Maybe it was Genghis Khan's leg. I don't know. I haven't seen that one enough in a while to know, but it was somebody's leg. One thing about this, in Where No Man Has Gone Before, Gary Mitchell brings up the fact that he took a poison dart from these rat creatures on this planet Demoris.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that later. But before that, we see a flashback when Kirk is transported to the Enterprise of 4 years ago. We see the Enterprise encounter the Klingons and they get attacked. The Enterprise doesn't want to attack them because they're not at war, you know. And the Klingons basically sucker punch them. Right. They pass each other and then they shoot at them anyway. And it creates this huge hole in the saucer of the ship. They evacuate and they realize Mitchell's missing. And Kirk goes into the debris and pulls him out as the seal. And we'll get to that in a minute. The force field seal starts to go out.
Right.
And they beam him out. And I don't think, having watched Where No Man Has Gone Before, I don't think Kirk saving Mitchell is ever mentioned. So I think this is Byrne's way of maybe softening what Kirk did, because
right.
that debt, the life for a life debt, had already been repaid, because he saved Gary's life before, and then Gary turned around and saved his.
Right.
So it paints Kirk in a better, more heroic picture. And not doesn't make him look as like he immediately turns on his friend and says, I'm going to drop him off in a place full of robot attendants at the lithium cracking station and leave his ass there. You know, it's like, that's what I'm going to do. You know, so, one thing, again, that whole part about the Enterprise, it's just, you know, seals the damage from the Klingon attack. I don't really recall that ever being mentioned in classic Trek.
Right.
I mean, I guess maybe it could be seen as a function of the shields. I mean, they never really go into too much of how...
Modulate the deflector shield?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
God, this isn't Next Generation. It's not the solution for everything. So, but you know, my memory may be foggy, but I that's kind of something new to me. But the flashback to the rodent attack on Demoris is actually is kind of neat, because the characters, you can tell they used footage from The Cage.
Yeah.
Because they have the gray jackets that they only wore in that. They didn't wear them in Where No Man Has Gone Before. So he's basically photoshopped, you know, everybody's heads onto the bodies of the actors from The Cage.
Mm-hmm.
And he's done a really good job with it. It looks good. The only thing is that the rat creatures are really just not very well defined, and it's hard to kind of make out what they are. I thought that was really the weakest point of the whole book.
I
couldn't really tell. If the dialogue wasn't there, you couldn't tell what was going on or what they even were supposed to be. Speaking of which, you know, he does a good job of keeping the effects Trek-like, and they're not too overblown. They're better than probably what you'd see in the 60s, but they still have that feel, you know. The glowing, shimmering Gary Mitchell's a good example. It kind of looks, reminds you of the cloud creature or the companion from the Zefram Cochrane episode.
Right.
It kind of reminds you of something like that. You know, when I reread this for taking notes, I kind of noticed then there was a lot of time spent going back and forth between the realities that Mitchell was creating and the real Enterprise and back to the planet and there was quite a bit of transporting going on. But really, in Star Trek, there is quite a bit of transporting that goes on in any given episode, especially one that centers around a planet. So when the first go around, it didn't stick out to me at all. When Kirk convinces Mitchell to let go of his human emotions and to outgrow the world he's in and his humanity, really, and he's, you know, really telling him to go where no man has gone before.
Right.
And which is really cool, and it's definitely, you know, like you said, that is the new experience, the places we've never been, the exploration of the human condition, you know, out in space. That is what Star Trek is, and it's neat that, you know, that alone makes this story very Star Trek like, and you know, it kind of mirrors other Star Trek stories like Star Trek the Motion Picture with V'ger and Uhlea and, you know, and Decker and all that. So it's got a similar vibe to that as well. The appearance of Number One at the story's end was a nice touch. In one of the DC comics that I fondly remember was the first Star Trek annual that they published, and that actually told their version of Kirk's first mission on the Enterprise. And it was basically the first part of that story took place as basically Pike's crew was leaving and Kirk's crew was coming on board. And unfortunately, Number One is killed during that transition. So it's nice to see her here. Of course, I know no non-film Star Trek is canon.
Right.
You know, so Star Wars is expanded universe fans, you know, it's always been that way with Star Trek. The animated series, they could, you know, it was canon and now it's not. And I don't know what it wasn't. I don't know if it is now or not, but. The zinger, Spock's zinger at the end is the highlight of the comic. Like I said, it nails those light whimsical moments at the end. You can just hear the music. You know, you can just hear that. I mean, you can just, and you know, Nimoy raising an eyebrow at Kelly as Kelly's walking out. Kelly like turns around and kind of glares at him and raises his own eyebrow. You know, they had eyebrow wars going on.
Hey, they need to get Capaldi in there.
yeah, he's got the... Look at these eyebrows! Look at them! A cross!
It's like giant caterpillars take a shit on my face.
He didn't say that.
Cut that part out.
Oh, no. There are two end features at the end of this book, both by Cliff Biggers. Video Killed the Photo Novel Star, which talks about the history of photo novels in general, and Trek ones in particular, in the decade immediately preceding the explosion of home video. And then there's an interview with John Byrne that I mentioned where he further details the whole process of how he came to the project and decided to do it in comic format versus the video format he originally intended. So that'll cover the first comic. We'll take a break and... When we come back, we'll cover Star Trek New Visions number 2, Time's Echo.
Mr. Scott, shall we give the Enterprise a proper shakedown?
I would say it's time for that, sir.
Before this drama unfolds, we give welcome to the ones named Kirk and Spock.
You! What planet is this?
Which one of you is the captain?
Did we violate the treaty, Captain?
Sir, someone is stealing the Enterprise.
What are you scratching at?
Humans make illogical decisions.
Distract sequence completed and engaged.
No! Yes, I follow Mr. Spock! I'm talking to Mr. Spock, you understand?
Starfleet, do you read? This is the Enterprise. We are under attack.
Fire, Mr. Scott.
Yeah!
Join Scott Gardner and Chris Honeywell, the two true freaks, every month for a new episode of Star Trek Monthly Monday. Every month you will get a classic episode of Star Trek the Original Series, a Star Trek comic, and who knows what else. Episodes of Star Trek Monthly Monday can be found for free at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com. Libsyn spelled L-I-B-S-Y-N. They can also be downloaded for free from iTunes.
Okay, we're back, and now we're going to cover Star Trek New Visions number 2. Like I said, I didn't wasn't able to get number 1, which actually number 1 is a sequel to Mirror Mirror, which so I definitely need to get that. But so issue number 2, the cover shows the Enterprise is like glowing orange and it's engulfed in flames and smoke as it spirals down through space. There's a red-tinted photo of the bridge crew, and then there's again framed shots of Kirk, Spock, Bones, and Scotty this time. There's also a small rectangular image of Yeoman Rand with the text plus, like plus Yeoman Rand. It's kind of odd, but it's in the Star Trek font, so it doesn't quite pop out at you. It's too strange. So the story is Time's Echo, and of course, photo montage and story by John Byrne, and of course, Star Trek created by Gene Roddenberry. Deep Space Monitor Station 18 picks up a puzzling transmission involving Captain Kirk and the Enterprise, emanating from the Galactic Core. An area no Federation ship has ever ventured to. Based on the endorsement of the station's commander by Lieutenant Uhura, Captain Kirk orders the ship to investigate. Arriving at the station, Spock and Uhura quickly discern the message is not only coming from the Galactic Core, but it is also, impossibly, 1,170 years old. Dun-dun-dun! This message also contains a set of coordinates outside the most hazardous regions of the core. After getting permission from Starfleet Command, the Enterprise makes its way to an area never before explored by man, replete with a black hole and an infinite number of gravity wells to navigate. On their way, Uhura and Spock decipher another part of the message, a course that appears to be an orbital escape vector. The planet at the coordinates is a dangerous one, with radiation levels that could prove dangerous to humanoids over long periods of exposure. Scanning the surface, Spock makes a startling discovery. The crashed remains of a starship with the familiar designation of NCC-1701, the call numbers of the USS Enterprise. Due to the harsh atmospheric conditions, the transporter cannot be used. So Kirk, Spock, McCoy, and Scotty head to the surface in a shuttlecraft. They find the crashed ship's power cells have been removed, indicating there may have been survivors. Scanning aboard the Enterprise, Sulu finds an even more shocking sight, and the landing party investigates. It is the saucer section of the Enterprise, with a city built around it. Dr. McCoy postulates the survivors of the crashed Enterprise and their descendants have built this city. They built this city on rock and roll.
I couldn't help but I was singing it in my head, too.
Cue Starship. Or the Muppets. Exactly. Or the Muppets, whichever. Spock observes that all of the buildings are similar and decaying, pointing to a stagnant society. As they approach the city on foot, they are blasted by some unseen force and are taken to the city by hooded humanoids, because Star Trek. Spock, McCoy, and Scotty are in prison, and while under cell, Spock hears a garbled form of English. Captain Kirk is taken to the people's leader, Croy. The masked Croy was anticipating the arrival of the Enterprise on this day. Kirk believes his host will help him avoid the crash, but Croy insists it must occur. In their cell, the others realize the planet's structures crudely approximate the features of the Enterprise, and that their attackers used a phaser set to stun. This indicates that some items salvaged from the ship are still working. Meanwhile, the Enterprise's orbit is decaying, and Chekov is unable to pinpoint the location of the landing party. Switching to DNA scans, he is shocked to find the DNA of the entire crew all over the planet. Croy confirms to Kirk that his people are indeed descendants of the Enterprise crew. They have awaited the coming of the Enterprise for 40 generations and have specifically honored the bridge crew, since they were mentioned in the records more than others. Croy produces a tricorder, and Kirk is able to witness the events that led to the crash. He sees that the falling ship does not have enough power to escape the planet's gravity, despite Spock's calculations. The science officer then suggests an implosion in the warp drive, creating a time warp. With no other choices available, the crew does just that, and the ship begins to rapidly travel backward in time, just as they still head toward the planet's surface. Kirk orders all crew into the saucer section for separation from the secondary hull. This causes the remnants of the ship to crash to the surface over 1,000 years ago. Croy confirms that nearly 250 crew members were lost in the crash, that these events are now in motion and cannot be stopped. Kirk orders Sulu to get the ship out of there by any means, and Croy assaults Kirk. He will not have their civilization, their very existence, threatened. Kirk cannot let those crew members die and offers Croy and his people a place aboard the ship, but Croy refuses. Kirk makes quick work of Croy and several other natives, the years of radiation mutating and weakening them. Having escaped their captors, Spock and the others rejoin their captain, and Croy lets them leave, believing nothing can stop the events of history from repeating. The landing party returns to a ship slipping ever faster into the heavy gravity of the planet. With the time warp solution not an option to avoid crashing, Spock suggests taking the ship into a power dive, cutting the engines and directing all power to the shields. This, in theory, may allow them to slingshot back into space, reignite the engines, and escape. With no other options, Kirk orders the plan into action. As the Enterprise dives toward the planet's surface, they scan the site of the ship's 1,000-year-old crash, but nothing remains. They have rewritten history.
And unwritten.
They have what?
Well, I mean, they're unwriting, you know?
Yeah, they have unwritten history. Yeah, that's true. They have unwritten history, and their descendants are no more, and never were. Despite the incredible strain on the ship, the plan works, and the Enterprise escapes the terrible pull of the planet. They are startled to find themselves near Earth once again, as if they never received Commander Resnick's call. Only the crew of the Enterprise recalls the mission, the planet, and their 40 generations of descendants. Despite the erasure from history, Kirk comments that they do remember them, and, quote, "Isn't that the only true form of immortality?"
That's cheap.
Now, I really like this one. I thought it was.
I'm talking about that particular
one. Oh, okay, but overall, I really thought this was a really clever time travel story with a nice hook. I'm curious though. You've got Commander Resnick at the beginning of the comic. You know, he doesn't look like anybody lifted from classic Trek. You know, I don't know if he's an IDW staffer or a friend of Byrne's, but he looks like somebody that Byrne is like cast in his comic. Another person that's cast in here that's kind of neat is. Somebody probably, when, you know, me, myself, I looked at that guy, I was like, yeah, I remember that guy from the show. Lieutenant Shea has been assigned to the subspace listening station. He was actually one of the crew members in the episode By Any Other Name, where I think he was actually one of the guys in the beginning that where they were turned into the cubes. They crushed one of them.
Oh, yeah.
That's the one where Scotty drinks the dude under the table.
Yeah.
Remember that? And they screw him up by
showing him human emotion,
yeah. And McCoy's happy to find Shay there because he had to reassign him to less strenuous duty after all that, which you can kind of understand why. You know, the whole idea of the mystery of Kirk sending a message from the past, that sounds like classic Trek. And, you know, it's kind of, in a weird way, I got to thinking about this. We covered... What the hell was the episode we covered?
I honestly thought about this message, I thought about Aquaman on the Super Friends episode. That's what I thought about with the Justice League communicator.
Yes, that is awesome. Because that is like, Rob, did you hear that? Cindy thought of something positive about Aquaman. we always got to bring up Rob. It's like we're name drop Rob in every episode. But yeah, that's right. That's true. Because yeah, Aquaman and Apache Chief are... They follow the Legion of Doom into the past, Black Man and a few others, and they get trapped back there.
Mm-hmm.
And Aquaman takes his atomic-powered Justice League signal device,
yep.
Buries it in the site of the Hall of Justice because Apache Chief uses Indian tracking powers to find it. And in the Hall of Justice in the present, Superman's like, what the hell's beeping? There's a hole in the floor. And it's like, it's Aquaman's communicator. And then they look at how much crusty junk's on it.
Right.
Well, it's been millions of years ago, so Superman cracks the time barrier and goes and gets them. It's like, awesome.
I'm sorry, but, I mean, that's what still makes sense.
Yeah, it's comic.
Still makes sense.
It's comic book sense, but damn it, it's good.
I mean,
you thought of that. I didn't think of that.
I know. No, I'm saying the whole, you know, That made sense. I'm not, you know.
I was thinking of the, we did the episode on all our yesterdays, the Star Trek episode.
Oh, yeah.
And you read the novels.
Yes.
That followed. And I remember you saying that the whole issue that came up was they found a cave drawing of a Vulcan on Serapeidan.
Right.
Which was Zara Beth's world. And later on, not after, you know, it couldn't have been a Spock. But so it was in the records of their history.
Right.
And so they had to go back to the Guardian of Forever and go back there and find out what had happened. That's what it made me think of.
Right. And they even talked about later, you know, his son said, why do you think the language of Serapeidan is English?
English, because he came to the Enterprise and learned
right
English and everything, then went back.
No, it's because Zara Beth learned it from Spock.
Oh, Zara Beth learned it.
And from Spock. She in turn taught it to him, who in turn taught it to the...
Oh, planet. Gotcha. Okay. Cool.
So there you go.
Yeah. This book has a lot more, because this is original story, there's a lot more recompositing of figures. There's a lot more new backgrounds. It's not quite, because it is more ambitious, there are a few more hiccups here and there. There's an alien woman on the substation. It's like purple, and I don't know if she may have been a new actress,
right,
quote unquote cast, and she's kind of got a few little fin things put on her. There's a couple shots with her that look a little off, but
the whole composite from the first one that we talked about, it was more smooth. It was more seamless.
Yeah.
You know, this one, while it went together and everything, I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
But where it was a new story, there wasn't as much for him to pull from.
Right.
And, you know, there was more actual structures that had to be made rather than out in the desert where it was before. Because, you know, Star Trek, they're always out in the desert.
Right.
But,
yeah.
But to me, it was more seamless with the other one rather than this one.
Right, yeah. Well, like I said, it was more ambitious, so, you know.
Right. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying, it is just
a
little
agree.
Bit different.
I do think the shots of the crashed Enterprise were really good.
Yes,
and
those are.
I was like, how in the world? One thing, though, Byrne has always been really good at is with tech stuff. And, he even was one of the, he very early on started using, like, 3D computer modeling to at least design vehicles and things, and if not actually start using digital models in his comics. Like, you know, I think he even did some of that in like Generations, the Superman Batman Generations.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, which, and it's kind of interesting because in a lot of ways, this has that same kind of feel that, retroactive history in some ways. He's filling in gaps and things, which he did that X-Men Hidden Years series too, that was similar. So you get the hooded figures that come and grab the crew after there's that. And they're I'm pretty sure, especially when you first see them, you just see the silhouette of them. They're completely Photoshop creations. But they got a real ethereal quality. It's just, they seem very creepy.
They reminded me, if you've read or seen Harry Potter, they remind me of the Dementors from Harry Potter.
Mm, yeah, yeah, I know what you're talking about, yeah. Or Jawas. Ootini!
No.
Okay. Croy is really creepy. He kind of reminds me of that old Titans character, Phantasm.
Mm.
Remember the floating cloak with the mask and
ended up being
Danny Chase?
I was gonna say.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, they actually made Danny Chase cool, then they killed him. But yeah, he's got like this very burlappy looking cloak and hood on, and then there's this almost scarecrow kind of like face, and you don't know what his face looks like underneath, and they never show him, but you kind of got to imagine he looks kind of nasty because they've been under all that radiation of that planet, and his hands are purple and kind of scabby looking.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, ew, what's that guy look like? You know?
I don't want to know.
No. And it's neat that they don't show what he looks like. Byrne's one break with the proper voice thing that I've really, really enjoyed with this is Uhura calls Chekhov Pav. For Pavel, you know, which, yeah, you know, I know she was likely to do that because, you know, they were seen in episodes like hanging out together, like with the Tribbles.
Right.
You know, and everything. But at the same time, she never did that on the show that I recall. And I'm pretty sure Chekhov's name was Pavel Chekhov even back then. He had a first name. A lot of them didn't. Like Sulu and Uhura didn't for years and years officially. But I don't think they would have called him Pav back then. One, I couldn't help but chuckle. Chekhov's line of, our DNA is all over the place.
That sounds dirty.
It made my inner 12-year-old chuckle. I mean, we know Kurtz is all over the place, you know, for sure, but like Star-Lord said, under a black light, it looks like a Jackson Pollock painting.
Ew. Oh, Christopher. Oh, honey, no.
You know, Spock suggesting a time warp, you know, that sounds about right. You know, it's just a jump to the left and then a step to the right. Put your hands on your hip.
Okay. We digress.
Yeah. The plan that they're, the fact that their plan didn't really work as well as they wanted and they had to go straight to survival mode, that was a nice touch. I mean, you usually don't see them make mistakes like this. I mean, they still survived, but obviously this wasn't the result they wanted. You know, so it's kind of nice to show them have clay feet. Of course, unlike other real people, they get a second chance to fix it.
Right.
But, you know, it was kind of nice to see Spock screwed up. You know, it's like he didn't get it quite right. His calculations were off, you know, off enough, or they just couldn't do it. You know, ship couldn't do it. She could not take the strain, Captain. That was one thing in these books.
And they ended up creating a civilization off of it.
Yeah, that is one thing. Scotty's dialogue. I mean, his dialogue sounded right, but the way that Byrne chose to write his Scottish brogue sounded a little like there was a few little words, and I can't think off the top of my head, I should have wrote this down, that I'm like, well, he doesn't really say it that way, he says it this way.
And, well, I'll tell you, I mean, something that, this is me, somebody who reads, like, all the time and everything else, when you write with an accent, whether it be Pavel Chekhov, whether it be Scotty, I'm spending so much time trying to translate that in my head.
Yeah.
That it takes me out of the story.
Mm.
To me, I would rather be able to see it as how the actual words are and translate it in my head.
You'd rather see Chekhov say nuclear vessels and then you change it to vessels.
Exactly.
Right, okay.
I mean, that's my personal preference.
Okay.
And I mean, that comes up a lot, especially when you have authors that are trying to write Southern.
Right.
And they obviously are from...
Not from the South.
Yeah, not from the South. And you're like, dude, I promise I am not that dumb. I mean, you know, it is one of those things, I would rather do the translation myself rather than someone write it in for me.
Right, right. Gotcha. Yeah, there was just a couple places here and there that just it took me out a little bit. You know, Croy, he really was a moron for not taking Kirk up on coming on the ship.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because
he's like, you know, Kirk's basically like, look, dude, I'm going to stop this. You know, he's like, well, you can't stop it. And he's like, whatever. You know, it's like, you can get back on your ship, but it ain't going to stop. It's like, yeah, well, guess what? If they stop it, dude, you're gone.
Yeah, like, never.
And they're gone. You know, Kirk is compassionate, but his compassion only goes so far, you know, and I think that's his primary concern always is his crew and by extension his ship.
Well, and you have to think, and I got to thinking about this. You and I had talked about this earlier about, you know, Kirk destroys, you know, 40 generations of his descendants, but he is more concerned about the people that are already here rather than
right.
a supposed question mark.
Right. Well, and I mean, he's thinking of, you know, do I kill 250 of my crew member and doom my crew to live on this harsh world, or, you know, in this harsh environment where, you know, God knows how long, how, you know, they obviously, you know, the first few generations probably suffered greatly as their bodies acclimated to this radiation.
Right, and lost more and they, people even then.
It was probably just barely, they barely survived the first few generations. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, he's really doing... it's unfortunate that the whole civilization disappears, can you know, especially since they're supposed to seek out new civilizations. But
right.
again, it's a stagnant one. But at the same time, it's still a civilization.
Yeah, kind of got to wonder about that. Why was it stagnant? Because you're on a starship of talented, brilliant individuals. Why was it stagnant?
Well, I got the feeling that. You know, like I said, a lot of them, the actual crew, probably died off pretty quickly. And I mean, they're
but they say that, you know, they've got a crew of over 400, 250 died in the crash. So that leaves 150 people with ideas. So why was it stagnant? Especially if you had, I'd like to know who the survivors were.
Well, you know Spock survived.
Well, if you have Spock and Scotty, McCoy, Kirk, if you've got those people, those are your inventors. Those are your scientists. They could have come up with something.
Right.
And so I kind of wonder.
Why did their, well, and, you know, maybe why, that's a good point. Why didn't their descendants do better even in those conditions?
Exactly.
Yeah, I could see that. But, I mean, you are talking 40 generations. I mean, eventually it's going to get kind of thin. You know, they probably.
Right. But you know, I'm still
the
saying.
The gene pool is going to get shallow.
But my point is, they show that this is a stagnant society from the get-go, is what was Spock's observation. Why?
Yeah.
Why, you know, like I said, you know, Starfleet takes the best.
Right, right.
So.
Yeah, that I could see your point there, yeah.
I would like to know who Croy
was. It makes you think, was he like the families of Kirk and McCoy, you know, from Croy?
Right, or, well, you know, who was he descended from?
Right, well, that's what I'm saying.
Know,
I mean, obviously, almost, you know, with only 150 people, they'd always have to be basically descended all from each other.
Right.
You know, I mean, eventually, of course, 40 generations, it's going to, you know, it's not going to matter that much anymore eventually, but yeah, their family tree don't fork much, you know.
No, kind of circles.
Yes, yeah, exactly. The solution that Spock comes up with, you know, I found myself, like, just like good Star Trek, when you're watching it, you're like, oh, yeah. And I thought to myself, like a stone on, like, when you, like, a skipping a stone in, like, a creek or something.
Right.
You know, that's what I was thinking of. You know, throw it at it really hard and it'll skip. And, you know, they never used that analogy, but that's what I was.
Right.
You know,
right.
I watch way too much Star Trek. So the shots of the Enterprise when it's all engulfed in flames, that's probably the only one they couldn't really do in the 60s. It wouldn't have looked that cool, but it still looks good, so you don't care, you know. And it made the cover, of course. So.
Oh, yeah.
The arriving back where they started was a little bit out there, kind of out there for me, but, you know, time paradoxes and stuff.
Well,
so.
You know, according to Doctor Who, timey-wimey, you know,
wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey. Yeah. You know, McCoy and Kirk's discussion at the end of the story is that, you know, it's very haunting and poetic. It's a nice wrap-up, and this one's in the vein of those episodes that don't always end, but, well, it's more of a dour ending, which there are Star Trek episodes
and
like
I mean,
that.
Here's the thing. I mean, people can say what they want, and I've been advocating this as far as for young adult literature that I'm buying for the library. You know, my predecessors tended to buy all the Hearts and Flowers, everything turns out okay. Well, guess what, kiddies? Life ain't like that.
Yeah.
Here's some reality.
But yeah, overall, I really thought this was you know, without being a sequel to another story, which Star Trek really didn't do hardly ever. I mean, definitely on the TV series it didn't. This felt, in some ways, this felt to me more like a lost episode of Star Trek. You know, the fans always want to write a sequel to a classic story. You know, the new kid coming in and playing with the toys, like Harv Bennett's, like, they give him Star Trek for Star Trek 2. He's like, what am I going to do? I don't know Star Trek. And he sits down and watches all the episode. And he, you know, watches Space Seed. And he's like, hey, they left me wide open, you know.
Right.
I can do this. And, I mean, just like, you know, everybody's got an idea. You know, every professional writer and every fanfic writer, you know, wants to do a sequel to a classic story, which is great. But to me, this one feels like a Star Trek story. It's got all the trappings of a Star Trek story, but it's a new Star Trek story. And I really like that aspect of it. So I kind of, between the two of them, I think I almost like this one better.
Nah.
But anyway. Well, there's actually another story in this one. And that's the plus Yeoman Rand story. So I thought I'd let you read the synopsizing on this one.
Sweet Sorrow, photo montage and story by John Byrne. The Enterprise arrives at Elsinore H-25 to pick up and transport an injured scientist. The man happens to be the former fiancé of Yeoman Janice Rand. Uhura approaches Rand about the situation and asks if it is Andrew who is coming aboard. Rand is surprised that Uhura remembers his name, but Uhura reminds her that he was all she talked about when she joined the crew. Rand visits sickbay and learns Andrew's condition was far worse than they expected, and Dr. McCoy isn't certain he'll survive the needed operation. Later, Uhura and Yeoman Tanya Barrows find an upset Rand in the rec lounge. Rand admits to her friend that only their careers came between her and Andrew, and she still cares for him. She is then summoned to sickbay, where McCoy relates that while he was able to save Andrew's brain functions, he'll be forced to live on life support. A heartsick Rand returns to her quarters and looks at pictures of her and Andrew in happier times. The medical ship USS Gregory rendezvous with Enterprise, and Kirk receives an unexpected request from Rand. The Yeoman is visited by Lieutenant Marla McGavers, who can't believe she is planning on leaving the ship. She wonders about Rand and the captain, but Rand is quick to point out that while there was once something there, the captain never acted on it, and Andrew needs her. As Mr. Kyle prepares to beam Rand aboard the Gregory, Captain Kirk enters the transporter room. The two share a knowing stare, but Rand orders Kyle to energize. The captain pauses a moment, turns, and leaves.
Yeah, Byrne here answers that age-old question. What happened to Yeoman Rand? This is a much nicer story than what really happened to the actress Grace Lee Whitney and what caused her to leave the show. Apparently, she had a very bad drug and alcohol addiction problem. Officially, the word was she was written out of the show to give Kirk a chance to find romance every week and not seem like a two-timer, but that wasn't really the reason. But, you know, luckily she apparently got herself cleaned up, and, you know, she showed up in a lot of the Star Trek films. So, Byrne does it again. The one thing that jumps out at me, he has Rand call Uhura Nyota. This really jumps out at me because I don't even think Uhura had that name back then. I think that's a fairly
recent addition.
Yeah, last 20, 30 years thing. So, she.
But I wonder, in one of the novels, I'm wondering if that was the name that they used in one of the novels that you have.
Well, some of the names I know that they came up with, like I think James, of course, and where No Man's Gone Before, there's a tombstone for Kirk that reads James R. Kirk, famously. But Kirk's was just, on the series, was just James T. Kirk. There was no explanation of what the T stood for. I think it was on the animated series that he was called James Tiberius Kirk. But then, of course, the animated series was in this kind of nebulous, is it canon, is it not?
Right.
And then some point after Next Generation, they decided it's not. In Star Trek VI, they called him James Tiberius Kirk. You know, General Chang calls him that. So they made it official. Sulu's name of Hakuru Sulu was approved by Gene Roddenberry some point in the 70s or early 80s, but not ever used until, I think, Star Trek VI again.
Right.
Captain Hakuru Sulu, USX Excelsior, you know. So Nyota may have been floating around out there, but wasn't officially.
Well, the reason I say that, and I should have done and went and pulled the book and looked for it, but
Which Star Trek novel is it?
Yeah, it's the one where Uhura, there's a musician that they're transporting, and she almost leaves the ship, and I read it like years
ago.
Yeah,
I remember that one.
Now, I might be.
Is that the one on where she's on the front of the cover in a cave?
Possibly.
Seems like I remember that.
Now, I might be completely wrong, but that doesn't ring like it's the same name.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, like it's a different name.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, that is her official name. You know, I think that's the one they use in the Abrams movies. And
like I said, I might be completely off base, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, we're not in that deep, so.
No. So don't write in telling me I'm wrong. If I'm wrong, I don't care. You're fine.
I'm just surprised you admit you were wrong. You know, it's nice the use of, you one-shot characters like Tanya Barrows. Byrne never even names the character, but, you know, I recognized her from the series. I was thinking she was from Shore Leave. I wasn't 100% sure, but I was right. That was the episode.
She's the one who was the princess, right?
Right.
With McCoy?
Mm-hmm. But I had to look her character name up. You know, I looked up Shore Leave. I looked up the character names in the Star Trek Companion. And then I had to look up her character, that character name in the Star Trek Encyclopedia, get the actress name. And then do a Google search, and then her face popped up. But I was able to confirm it was She was from Shoreleave, and yeah, that is her. Okay.
Yeah, you put a lot more thought into that than I ever would.
Yeah. I was like, well, it was bugging me. It's like, what episode is she from? I'm pretty sure it's Shoreleave. So then he pulls out Marlon MacGyver's, which, of course, we all know that's Khan's woman.
Right.
You know, from Space Seed, and, you know, the one that dies in City Alpha, whatever it is, and the reason Khan goes extra bat crap. You know, we see Andrew in the pictures.
Sure. Yeah.
I wonder who he was.
Yeah, I wondered that as well.
Yeah, it's probably another one of Bird's friends or something. The ending to this one is just a real heart wrencher. It's really well played. I mean, you know, Kirk walks in and finds these two ladies. He's too late to say a proper goodbye, and he's far too late to act on the feelings that they had for each other, him and Rand. The shot that Byrne grabbed for Kirk's reaction is just great. I'm not 100% sure, but it looks like it might be from the end of City on the Edge of Forever, because Kirk's just got this, just like, oh, you know, just like totally defeated look on his face as she beams away, you know. But, you know, too little, too late. So that was a really powerful, it was a very short story, but it was a good one, you know. It was a nice cap to that. We, you know, see what happened to Yeoman Rand, who figured pretty prominently in the very earliest of episodes. Final thoughts on what these two issues. You know, to me, this does feel more like classic Trek than just about any other attempt, be it, you know, novel, comic book, any kind of other adaptation. It really does. I mean, he really captures the flavor. Byrne knows the show. And he knows to pull just the right shots to convey the action and move his story forward. Like I said, he nails the voice of the character. You know, between having the visual of the actor and then him know the character so well, you really do feel like you're watching a lost episode of Star Trek when you read these. You know, I'm definitely going to get the other two issues that are out there, which, like I said, Mirror Mirror sequel and the Doomsday Machine.
Especially Mirror Mirror.
Yeah, the Doomsday Machine. Well, the Doomsday Machine's a damn good episode, too.
And I'm saying my personal favorite.
Well, everybody likes Mirror Mirror, of course, but, you know, who doesn't like parallel Earth stories, you know? We all do. But, and that's a great one. It's like the granddaddy of all parallel Earth stories for, you know, popular mediums, anyway. Yeah, if you're a Star Trek fan and a comic fan, I can't recommend these enough to you. You know, if you're a John Byrne fan, you know, of his writing, then, you know, here's another great example of his writing. Go check them out. I think there is a trade paperback now that probably collects all of these. Of course, since I got the first two, there's not much point in getting a trade paperback. But yeah, there's a trade paperback out that's collecting these, so definitely go out and check it out. And, you know, when we get the other two, we might cover those too, but they're just a whole lot of fun. Especially, you know, and I like, actually, you know, don't throw rocks at me like I said before, but I like the Abrams movies, but this feels a lot more like classic Star Trek. So next time, as we mentioned, we're going to have a guest who contributed to the 1966 Batman Blu-ray and DVD box set, and that mystery guest is none other than Brian Hyler. Brian is the mastermind behind Plaid Stallions, which is a website that celebrates all the funky things from the 70s and early 80s, everything that's orange and brown and groovy. And he is also the host of the Pod Stallions podcast that comes from Plaid Stallions, which is a great show that I highly recommend. He is also the editor-in-chief of the Mego Museum. This can be found at megomuseum.com. That is my internet home away from home. Obviously, it's centered around the Mego toy company. It's just great for all sorts of genre goodness. And that's actually where the credit for the Batman DVD comes in. Brian provided commercials that he had from the Mego magnetic Batman and Robin from the 70s. And they're actually shown in a documentary on there about Batman collectibles, and he and the Mego Museum get a credit. So when I saw that, I was like, woohoo! In addition to all that, Brian is also the author of Rack Toys, which is a book that is about the Rack Toys, the cheap, very cheap priced and cheaply made toys that used to hang in grocery stores and that we used to, you know, beg our parents to buy us. And so that's a great book, and I highly recommend that one, too. So Brian's going to be stopping by. And as we get into the holiday season, it's a perfect time to talk about stocking stuffers that we had. In particular, what we're going to be talking about are coloring books, which we all know and we've all had and we still buy for our kids. And Presto Magics, which is probably something that's not around nowadays, but was quite a bit of fun. They were transfer sheets. You would like take a pen and rub across images of Batman and Robin and transfer them onto a background of like Gotham City. So we're going to talk about that. So it's going to be me, Cindy, and Brian rapping about coloring books and Presto Magics. If you got any comments on this episode, you can give us an email at supermatespodcast@gmail.com, or you can go to our supermatescomic.blogspot.com site and drop a comment. You can also leave a comment on Facebook. If you feel froggy and want to leave a review not view on iTunes, that'd be great. As we record this, Thanksgiving's a couple weeks away, and as it comes out, it should be right the week before Thanksgiving. So we thought we'd leave you with some words of wisdom from our beloved captain about being safe this Thanksgiving season. So, happy Thanksgiving. Enjoy the tryptophan. Bye.
Bye.
Supermates is a Franklin & Franklin production in association with Bugaloo Enterprises Worldwide. The fictional characters and events mentioned in this show are trademarked and copyright their respective owners. Likewise, all audio clips are copyright their owners, and we mean no infringement by either. Thank you for listening to Supermates, the husband and wife geek cast.
Hi, I'm William Shatner, and I love fried turkey, but turkey and oil are a dangerous combination. So watch this video. I want your comments on it. I want to know how you plan to keep yourself, your family, and me safe from turkey fryer fire.
I want a deep fried turkey.
I want a moister, tastier turkey.
I want a deep fried turkey.
I want a moister, tastier turkey.
It started as a hunger. I was young and arrogant. I was young and arrogant. Blinded by my hunger, I ignored safety.
I want a deep fried turkey.
I want a moister, tastier turkey.
I want a deep fried turkey.
I want a moister, tastier turkey.
When I laid my hands on that fryer, I didn't want to let go.
And go.
Back then, everyone was doing it. Everyone was doing it.
I once loved this piece of metal.
Keep yourself, your family, and me safe from turkey fryer fire. So dangerous.
So dangerous.
You can't even imagine. Fried turkey tastes great. Great taste. I love fried turkey.
Did you ever do same?
Pot.
Thermometer.
Dingle dangle. Dingle dangle.
Pot.
Thermometer.
Where's the dingle dangle?
Olive oil. Wet frozen turkey. Pushed together, make steam.
Pushed together, make steam.
Pushing the hot oil and igniting on the open flame.
I want a deep fried turkey.
I want a moister, tastier turkey.
I want a deep fried turkey.
I want a moister, tastier turkey.
Blinded by my hunger, I ignored safety. I ignored safety.
Spat in the face of science.
Turn off the flame. Turn off the flame.
Oh my goodness! What am I doing? Oh, oh, oh! Look at this. That is so stupid.
Keep yourself, your family, and me safe from turkey fryer fire. So dangerous,
so dangerous.
You can't even imagine.
I want a deep fried turkey.
I want a moister, tastier turkey.
I want a deep fried turkey.
I want a moister, tastier turkey.
That fryer took so much from me. But it gave me a healthy fear. Fire, metal, oil, and turkey are glorious when in harmony, but their power is unrelenting in a careless hand.